Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Klatch. This is Marianne Russo. I want to say hello to Chuck Wally, who's going to be over on the Twitter tweet chat. I will be joining him in a little bit. And anyone can come and interact. Our Twitter tweet chat has the hashtag TCK, and we will be taking callers at the end of the interview. The Keeping All Students Safe Act responds to a critical need to have national standards on the use of seclusion and or restraints in our schools. The bill prohibits the use of mechanical and chemical restraints, limits the use of restraints to emergencies, and only when less restrictive measures have failed. Instead of IEPs allowing for restraint and seclusion, IEPs can be supplemented with behavioral intervention plans that rely on trained staff to de-escalate crisis situations without relying on restraints and seclusions, and it can also mandate that parental notification of emergency situations is immediate. The Senate version of the bill differs from the House version in allowing seclusion and restraints to be included as interventions in the child's IEP plan. We have all seen, unfortunately, the effects of thousands of instances where children who expect us to protect them have been hurt and sometimes even killed by being secluded and restrained. We all need to act to protect these children, most of whom are autistic or have other special needs, and sadly some that are unable to even communicate for themselves. Tonight we have two incredible advocates on the topic of restraint and seclusion, our own moderator, Mae Wilkinson, and our special guest, Doug Riggs. Hi, how are you? Also discussed tonight, we hope to get in the autism insurance reform to ensure these children get the treatments and therapies they need and to take the tremendous emotional and financial burden off of an already stressed autistic family. Doug Riggs was appointed by Missouri Governor Jay Dixon to be an advocate for people living with developmental disabilities. He was appointed to the Missouri Planning Council for Development Disability, and he is the father of a son with intellectual disability. Doug has been fighting for the rights of children and adults with mental illness and autism for over 25 years. It is a pleasure to have him join us. Welcome, Mae and Doug. How are you?
We're doing great. Thank you, Marianne.
Terrific. Tonight, I'm going to be turning the mic over to Mae. And I'm going to be jumping on the Twitter tweet chat, so please join us there and listen in. Have a great interview.
Thank you. So, Doug, I think tonight's talk may contain some content that will be upsetting to some parents. So in order not to frighten them, let's talk a little bit about the broader issue, how parents can help keep their children safe in school. Let's talk about some broad guidelines there before we start getting into the definitions and some of the stories about restraint and seclusion. Can you help us out there?
Well, I think, you know, the first answer to that question is to the question of how they can help is parents can get involved. Parents need to be showing up at school periodically when they can, you know. IEP meetings and keeping an open dialogue with the team of people that are responsible for the education and the safety of your child while he or she is at school is crucial. There is no one who knows a child better than a parent. The parent is the number one expert in who a child is and how they understand the world and how they go about interacting with other people. And so, you know, every parent's voice needs to be a part of the dialogue, a part of the ongoing discussion about how we support, how we encourage a child in school.
Very good. So I think your point is never advocate. Always try to monitor and be there to correct things before they escalate to restraints and seclusion practices. So by way of background, Doug, are restraints and seclusion or behavioral interventions always bad?
I think it really gets to the point of trying to define the terms.
Okay.
There's a wonderful form of intervention called positive behavioral interventions and supports. It's been around. It's been supported by a lot of research, and it is basically very, you know, there's what they call in the world of psychology, they have negative reinforcements and positive reinforcements. And a negative reinforcement is the slap on the hand when the kid reaches for the candy, and the positive reinforcement is, well, you know, if you get your homework done, I'll be happy to give you a piece of candy. So that's, you know, when we look at it in terms of how we encourage a child, how we provide positive encouragement to every child toward a reward or toward, you know, success in the school, that's kind of the distinction between non-adversive interventions and adversive interventions. Because an adversive intervention intends harm toward a child. That's what we need to do away with, in my opinion.
Can you give us some examples of the aversive and non-aversive?
I think if you intentionally give a child a drug, let's say this is what they call a chemical intervention, in order to sedate that child or in order to put that child in a calmer state, that I find that to be adversive.
Mm-hmm.
I find intentionally altering the state of the child's mind is an adversive form. I think, and that's the chemical stuff. But then, you know, there's a school in Massachusetts that uses electroshock in a classroom with kids with autism, and that's as adversive a form of intervention as I know of going on in the country. I mean, it was deemed to be torture by United Nations, and the Department of Justice is looking into it right now. They haven't come up with their report yet, but that's, you know, when you intend harm toward a child in order to communicate to them what it is that you expect of them, there's no reason to believe that that's an effective form of helping a child learn.
Oh, jeepers. Well, what about seclusion? Any aversive or non-aversive methods of, you know, what's the difference there?
Well, I think there's a lot of steps before you get to that point.
Okay.
The three key items that they've been talking about in nationally and in the states is seclusion, isolation, and restraint. Okay. Well, there are so many other things that need to be going on between the educators and the child, or the support team and the child, to make them feel comfortable and safe and to make them feel that they don't need to respond to their environment in an aggressive fashion, okay? These forms of the seclusion or the isolation or the restraint of a child is, it compromises the child's safety, you know? I mean, there's no way of going into any of that without putting the child at risk. And what I've read and what I've learned in looking at this issue is that we need to begin to open up a discussion with teachers and educators about all the ways that you can de-escalate something as simple as lowering your voice, you know, something as simple as not getting excited in that moment as well, you know, is a form of de-escalating the situation. So there's so many ways of intervention that are very, you know, are just kind of common sense in some ways, but they need to be happening long before these more restrictive forms of intervention take place.
I see.
I'd be happy to talk about the restrictive forms, but I just wanted to put that out there first it's tough stuff, and I want to encourage parents to get involved with their schools in a way in which they're looking at first and foremost, you know, before we go into any less restrictive situation, or before we get to the point of having a crisis intervention, okay, which is a definition they use in the policies, that we're looking at how to not get there, how to keep a child engaged in their school, engaged in their social relationships, engaged in a classroom, you know. And there's so many wonderful ways of doing that.
That's just such a good point, Doug. And one of the best analogies I ever heard was one of the best things that I heard was making sure you set the appropriate expectations for all parties. A buddy of mine always said that having a child with autism be able to sit in the chair or make eye contact is not dissimilar from having a child in a wheelchair be asked to climb 3 flights of stairs. So even starting with the expectations and the understanding of what the child's needs and issues are is a critical first step. Am I correct?
You don't get water out of a rock.
Okay.
I have my strengths and I have my weaknesses as a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, we all do. We all come into this world, or during the time we're here, we come to understand those. And, you know, most people that are successful have a very strong understanding of what they're capable of and what is a struggle for them, you know. We build on people's capacities. We don't throw challenges up to them that only accentuate their inabilities, you know.
Very good.
Let me spend some time telling you what you cannot do, and we'll see how you feel about it by the end of the conversation.
That itself starts creating that anger that builds and builds year after year after year that can explode into violence at some point. How about
we have children that aren't able to communicate, mm-hmm, through any other means than their behavior, and unless people understand that behavior is a form of communication, that every behavior a child exhibits, they are saying something. And if you fail to look at that and say, oh, well, what is that child trying to communicate to me? What is that child trying to tell me now? Instead of, oh, I'm really offended by that. Instead of personalizing, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's the distinction, I think, that I worry about when we okay very aversive forms of behavioral intervention. What I worry about is that the teacher or the educator that's standing there isn't going to be able to make that distinction, you know. They aren't trained to make that distinction well enough. And the distinction is that the child is behaving in a certain way, and that's a form of communication. I need to figure out what they're trying to say, what they're trying to tell me in this moment. They're uncomfortable with the lights. They're uncomfortable with there being too much noise right now. They're uncomfortable with the fact that I have my hand on their shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Sure, I do. I really do. And by the way, to our audience, I can say that both Doug and my child have been restrained at some point. It's not an easy thing to get through for anybody, especially the child. So Doug, some more of these aversive, because sometimes parents may not know what's being done to their child is wrong. So physical restraints, particularly the prone and the face down, those are very dangerous for a child. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, our state has already said, no, you will not do that.
Okay.
I don't believe all states have come to that conclusion yet.
Okay.
I believe that in the federal law they came to that conclusion, but of course they haven't passed it.
Okay. And then we have the chemical restraints, which are some of the drugs or, God forbid, the pepper spray. And you also have mechanical restraints. Can you talk a little bit about what is a mechanical restraint?
Any device that straps you or secures you to something like a chair or even to yourself. A gross example would be a straitjacket, but, you know, someone's shirt can be used in that manner as well. Or, I mean, anything that's a mechanical restraint, anything that you use to secure a child to where they're immobile.
So straps, handcuffs, all of those, even the child's own clothing can be used as a mechanical restraint.
Yeah, handcuffs are not allowed, and schools aren't going to be using handcuffs.
No.
And schools aren't going to be using pepper spray either.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you get into a situation where a child, especially an older child and a much bigger child, was threatening everyone, most of what policies I'm looking at and my understanding, at least in Missouri, is that they're going to be leaning towards securing the child somewhere and calling the police to come in and intervene. And at that point, you know, what the police use at that point on a child is kind of up to their policies and how they approach situations. One of the things I advocated for as we were having this kind of discussion, because I've been assisting a local school district, I've been sitting on the committee developing their policy around seclusion, restraint, and isolation. And I said, a police officer is totally unfamiliar with a child, you know. They're totally going to, you know, they're coming in totally blind, and it just doesn't, you know, I look at this stuff and I say, you know, we need to be doing a whole lot more to support our children to feel safe in school right up front. And if a child has a problem, I don't know that I hear so much about someone going into a crisis mode without giving a lot of pre-warning, you know? Mm-hmm. I think before a child goes into a complete and total meltdown where they're attacking everyone around them, that there's a lot of cues before that, that teachers and everyone needs to be paying a lot of attention to. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
And very wise words, and I think it's something that we all can understand. What I still don't quite understand, and perhaps you can help us with it, is there are some parents who are so terrified that their children will hurt themselves or other students that they want some sort of restraint and seclusion policy available. You know, there's some parents who say, get rid of it altogether, it doesn't belong in school. But some parents are just really, really worried that their kids are going to hurt somebody.
Well, there's very minor types there's very minor techniques for teachers to actually protect themselves from getting their hair pulled or from, you know, being bit or having their clothing pulled, okay? And there's training in this that school districts provide. On a more restrictive way, in a more restrictive sense, the physical restraint is usually, you know, grabbing a teacher taking a hold of a child's wrist, you know, and just securing them and holding them. And they say that the, you know, of course, you have children that aren't able to communicate. You have children that have very high thresholds for pain. You have children that are unable to communicate when they're being hurt, and don't even, some who don't even experience it. So there are ways, and the district that I've been working with has been wonderful about saying that these restraints will not take place with anyone who's not fully trained in how to perform them. And they also go into details about what that training is, okay? And so if for people who are trained, much like police officers are trained in how to, you know, how to restrain someone in a situation and not hurt them and not get hurt, okay? It's similar training. But what I also understand is that if you put pressure, if you put someone in a situation where they're face down, that can limit their breathing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody understands that there's ways in which you can put pressure on, I mean, there are children that have fairly fragile bones due to physical conditions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So putting weight on a child could seriously injure that child. Again, I always keep coming back to the less restrictive approaches, and the more that we focus on those, the better off everybody is. I think if somebody gets to the point of crisis intervention, of to the point where they're harming other children, or could be harming other children through their actions or themselves. Okay, that's how they define crisis intervention. They also define it sometimes when a child is destroying property. Now, personally, I find it pretty offensive that someone puts property ahead of my child's safety.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a child's tearing pages in a book, I don't think that's ground for restraint. And I've heard situations where children were restrained for compliance issues. They weren't doing their homework in school.
Mm.
Okay? Mm. So, you know, policies, and you think, wow, it's a no-brainer that we wouldn't be restraining a child for not doing their work in a classroom, right? Well, it's not. And policies need to be having that kind of detail, apparently. Okay? I mean, that needs to be on the table. That needs to be in the discussion. Because you cannot, you know, we need to understand the distinction between these less restrictive forms of intervention and non-aversive forms, and these more restrictive forms. Isolation is basically putting a child, it could be blocking a doorway and keeping a child in a room. It could be putting a child in an empty room and holding the door shut.
Oh, gosh. Oh,
isolation.
Dad.
And in what I'm hearing in the discussion statewide is that the big difference here is whether that door is locked and unattended, okay? That's a child in a room, in a crisis situation, maybe intending harm towards someone else or themselves, and they're put into a room by themselves, locked, and no one's even looking after them. Unacceptable. There's no way that's okay. If you know, I mean right?
Well, it's shocking, and I'm wondering why it's gotten to this point. I think you were telling me that during our pre-talks that it's sort of this rise of the co-teaching model that, you know, it used to be that these kids were put into segregated classrooms. Now that we all believe in inclusion, that just the infrastructure isn't there to support it, the understanding of the child's needs. We don't understand if that child is being bullied because he or she may not be able to communicate. We don't understand if there's just too much going on and it's sensory overload. We don't understand if they might not be feeling well. So I just, but how do we get to that point of, okay, so some children are disruptive, to putting the electrodes on their heads or sticking them in rooms by themselves? Why has it taken so long for legislators to start thinking about and school districts to start thinking about putting policies and guidelines in place?
Because we didn't take a strong stand. Because we come from a culture where we trust teachers, we trust the experts, I believe in trust. I mean, I give my trust with my child's teachers. I give that trust up front. They don't have to earn that. You know, I mean, I'm kind of old school that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when that trust was broken, I mean, I told them up front. I said, if you break the trust, it's going to be really tough to get it back. You know?
Well, then maybe this is a good time to start talking about how to put together a policy. So why don't we start with the case in Missouri? How did we get from doing nothing to to having a state law in the books mandating a policy to actually having a draft ready for the public's review. Can you talk about the whole history of the effort?
Well, there were a couple of news stories that broke,
mm-hmm.
and about seclusion rooms in our state. And there were a couple of absolutely wonderful parent advocates who stepped up and really, you know, felt a great deal of passion about this, and took a strong initiative with our lawmakers here, and we got a law passed to basically mandate it that all school districts in Missouri would have a policy in place around seclusion, restraint, and isolation by July of 2011. And at that point, the Department of Education in Missouri got together with a few some experts and parents and whatnot, and they put together a model policy. And also the Missouri School Board Association put together a model policy. And they sent those out to the districts, to all the districts. And at this point, I've actually been in touch with my local districts and offered my help, you know. And I think in any state where they're moving forward in establishing policies in every school district, that somebody from that school district needs to step up, you know. I don't know that it takes. I think you have to be a good listener. I think you have to be willing to speak out when something comes across that makes no sense at all. Much like leaving a child unattended in a room that's locked. That makes no sense at all. I mean, to a parent. I mean, I can't even imagine who ever even thought up such a thing, you know. And being able to, I think, you know, getting involved in this process only, it doesn't require, I mean, there is, I spent a great deal of time reading and learning what other states were doing and keeping in touch with things like the Council for Parents, Attorneys, and Advocates mm-hmm. put together some interesting stuff. There's another group called Appraise, which is the Alliance to Prevent Restraint, Aversive Interventions, and Seclusion. And I've read materials from those organizations. And so I come in educated, but I don't know that everybody needs to go and read all this stuff to be effective in helping their district develop a policy. And I don't know that a state has to be mandating it either. I think if a parent goes into their school district and says, you know, do you have a policy in place for this? And if you don't, shouldn't we be putting it together, because something this serious deserves a policy. Something this serious deserves guidelines, you know, for teachers.
You know, that's a good thought. I always thought that it, you know, you had to have a mandate, and then the state had to adopt it, and then it trickled down in the district. But we forget how much power parents do have to craft policy or even raise awareness for it. So let's say that you do go into a school district and you want a policy and you want to do it fairly. What's I'm sure there would be some sort of a committee to help research and draft the verbiage for the guidelines. What types of team members would you recommend being on that committee to help draft the policy? Who needs to be involved? How do you stakeholder it?
Well, you stakeholder it with people from all different aspects of special education field. But also, I would say have a general education teacher there as well,
mm-hmm.
you know. Maybe have a principal in the group. Principals are certainly, you know, this is important to them too. But also, you know, people that work directly with our children. teachers, and in our school we have a speech therapist, and we have someone who's an occupational therapist. School nurse might be a good person to have involved in this. And then I guess if I was just doing it that way, I'd probably, somebody within the group would need to take a leadership role, but they would also need to go out and find a model to start with. You can't go into this just, there's no way, to go in and start developing a policy without seeing what other policies look like. And looking through them and determining what's a strong one, and then you form that policy for the individual district, you know.
Now, one of our tweeters mentioned that okay, policy is good, but there's also a little bit of triage to it. You've got to stop the abusive practices. How would you recommend doing that, Doug?
Well, within the policy that I just got to be a part of, there's a wonderful line right at the end, and it's about accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, I want to make sure I get this right, but it basically says that violation of this policy by district personnel may result in disciplinary action up to and including termination. Wonderful thing to put in a policy. And if a person actually reads the policy, that being the last line, might have a pretty good impact on them. We don't have a central location pulling together the data of these kinds of incidents taking place in our state. And we need it. There needs to be, if someone crosses the line, school districts are very isolated in how they operate, and there's no, if your child is injured, in Missouri, a teacher is very much protected legally, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know that, but it's true.
Yeah.
They're very protected here.
Mm-hmm.
So the district really is the final say in terms of taking some kind of action, disciplinary action against the teacher. I think what I'd like to see is that when a district pulls in data about, you know, all the incident reports coming in, that they share it with some kind of central location so that we have some kind of understanding of all of what is happening in our state, that somebody in a, and maybe it's the state's protection and advocacy group, you know, who I think is a wonderful group to be looking at this information because they're separate. They're not the Department of Education, which tends to protect the school districts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're outside of that. There's someone with an objective eye. That would be ideal to me.
Okay. So if for those parents, and again on Tweet Chat, we're hearing stories of children who are being restrained in school now.
Mm-hmm.
So they should first file a complaint against the you know, talk to the teacher or the special ed teacher, talk to the principal. If the issue isn't resolved, take it upstream to the administration of the district, and probably at the same time also talk to Protection and Advocacy Services. And we can send out the link to a website that lists Protection and Advocacy Service contact information for each state, so we can get that out to our audience too. So that's sort of the path of progression, correct?
There's one step above that.
Okay, what's that?
That's the U.S. Department of Justice.
Okay.
Office of Civil Rights.
And we know that those guys are serious. We've seen some of their actions thus far, and they take those claims very seriously.
Even as I say that, I also want to throw a caveat down,
mm-hmm.
and that is, you're going to get a lot further by going to that teacher first, by going
right.
to the principal of that school first, by going into your IEP team first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going up the chain of command, so to speak, which is what they do in corporate America. Yet, right? You don't you don't, you know, you come and deal with the person who the issue's with. And then if you don't feel like it's resolved, you go to their supervisor, you know. But then at that point you say, look, I came to you and you did nothing about this, you know. And so that's why I went to the principal, or that's why I went to the school board, you know. But we don't proceed if you can fix the problem, you know. And in this, in much of this situation, the problem is that they don't have a policy in place, that they're running blind. All right. I mean, there's school districts all over Missouri that have absolutely no policy about this, but they're doing this stuff, you know. That's ludicrous.
Yes, it is. So,
they have a policy about everything, and they're missing this.
I know. So, what do you think about if you sense that your child is in danger from being restrained or secluded? Do you recommend pulling them out of school while this inquiry is going on, or keeping them, you know, seeing what happens after you approach the teacher? Does it get to a point where parents have to pull their children out of that school?
Well, there's two thoughts I have, and it's hard to separate them. One is that if a teacher has been trained in how to restrain a child and they go into a restraint with a child, regardless of the reason, you know, and you that night see that there's bruises on your child's wrist, you know,
mm-hmm.
as a parent the next morning you want to talk to the police, maybe. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. as a parent you just freak out in that moment. I do.
Okay.
I mean, I admittedly do.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you really have to proceed in a way in which you can make it work over time. You know, if there's something going on that your child's safety is being compromised in school, then you need to deal with it within the school. But there's also something called hotline services in a lot of districts. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but mm-hmm. where they have a hotline if a parent feels that their child is being abused in any way at school, you can just call and they will look into it.
Very good.
Are you still there?
I am still there.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I'm listening. I think the hotline is a really great opportunity for parents who may not be confrontational, who may be frightened, and they can call the hotline and say, my child came home with bruises today and is afraid of his teacher and said that the teacher did this or that. And the hotline would be a great intermediate step, because I know some parents are very frightened about confronting principals and teachers. But let's go
forward.
Well,
that's your team. That's your team too. You know, that's the people that are supporting your child.
That's right.
And you know, me, I'm kind of like, you know, I'm the papa bear. You know, I mean, I'm very protective about my kids.
Sure.
I just.
Well, Doug, let's do this. Pretty soon we'll be taking questions, but I want to get in one big thing first, and that
okay.
is let's assume that the school district or the school are willing to put in a policy. What are the critical elements of that policy? I know you talked about definitions, and you talked about kind of the rules of engagement. When is it appropriate? When is it not? So will you talk a little bit about the must-haves in a policy?
Well, first off, the must-haves start with the policy should progress from least restrictive to most restrictive. So
okay.
right up front, we need to be talking about de-escalation techniques, you know, solving problems, making changes in the environment to accommodate a child's needs, you know, sensory breaks for children that need those. You know, encouraging a child, smiling, you know, using a tone and trying to, you know, be very clear in your speech with the child and figuring out what what that child's trying to communicate in their speech or their behavior, you know. Just always reaching out to listen to and hear what that child's trying to say, but also in your communications too, that, you know, these are what they call de-escalation techniques. These are, well, gosh, these are just like common sense. How do we go about connecting and establishing a rapport with a child to optimize their educational experience and their sense of safety in a classroom, okay? So those kinds of things need to be promoted right up front, as well as this positive behavioral interventions and supports. And some of that's, there's some school-wide approaches to that, but basically we understand that we're always doing positive interventions. We're always moving toward building on the child's strengths, okay? That's kind of basically what that PBIS stuff is, from what I understand. And then I believe that if those things are in place and really supported in a school district and in any school, that you're going to have a very, very small number of problems going on at all that escalate beyond, you know, just, you know, someone stubbed their thumb or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I very much believe in when a child feels listened, feels secure and safe, when a child feels that people are communicating with them and making an effort to communicate to them in an effective way, that's like 90% of what, when that's not there, that's what kind of brings us to the next step, okay? I think going into crisis mode is something that happens when we don't feel secure, when we don't feel heard, when we don't feel connected with those around us, when we don't feel safe. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's my read on all my education around this. At that point, though, there are less restrictive approaches to restraint. There's ways of taking your child's hand and leading them out of a classroom. This is in a sense isolating a child by just taking them out of the noise of the classroom to an area where they have less noise, maybe less light. You know, maybe they just need a break, what they call a sensory break, from all of the activity that's going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to read. I'm sorry, what?
No, I think I see where you're going with this. Most of the policies are 90% what to do in crisis situations and 10% on how to de-escalate it. And you're saying a policy needs to be 90% on the prevention side and then 10% on the crisis intervention, because if you do the first 90% right, then you won't need the 10%.
Did I say that, May?
Well,
that was brilliant.
Good. Well, all right. Well, I'm glad I paraphrased it correctly. But are times when the crisis is going to occur. And there are times, Doug, unfortunately, human nature being what it is, there are going to be times where a child may be mistreated in school. And some of our audience are just doing wonderful, making wonderful suggestions. They're suggesting videotaping the conversation that you have with your child or the bruises and then sending it to school, or asking or looking for signs that the child is being abused at school because they have a stomach ache or a headache or they don't want to go to school on Sunday night, so lots of anxiety. So start looking for those signs. And I think that crisis management part is still going to be very important, to put down rules. You do not use physical restraints on a child. You do not use mechanical restraints on a child. You may only put them in a seclusion room until the police arrive, if calling the police is absolutely necessary.
In a room under observation.
And in a room observation.
Where someone's looking at them the entire time.
Absolutely. Marianne,
yep.
Are we about ready to take calls?
Yes, we are. I just want to say this has just been such an emotional chat and the parents over on Twitter really, you know, we have a lot of people that are on that are advocates. We have some facilities that are on, you know, boarding schools and residential placements, and, you know, they're even appalled by what they're hearing. We do have quite a few callers, but before we do that, if you could find the hotlines for us, a lot of parents would like to know what numbers, where they could find a hotline number for their areas.
I will look into that, and also
and
the
we'll get that posted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll post that also on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm going to start taking some calls. So we're going to start with area code 202. Area code 202, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And some of my initial questions you already answered, because I think that we should have a very low tolerance for people putting their hands on their children. And my question really is, what the damage of the seclusion and restraint does to the child? What's the damage that does? I mean, it seems to be a frustration or lack of training on the teacher's part. And I do like the comments that you made of emphasizing more training. It's not really de-escalation. It's just how do you treat people?
Mm-hmm.
And what have you seen on the studies? How this affects a child? Will a child not want to go to school? Will they be traumatized for the rest of their life? You see this happening with adults, and I'm going to let you answer.
Great question.
Should I take this?
Sure, Doug.
Go
yes,
right ahead.
Absolutely.
Well, first and foremost, I think children are wonderfully resilient. I think they're, you know, given the opportunity, I think they can bounce back from just about everything. I believe that about children. I've certainly seen it in my child. But when you start setting up certain patterns where you are grabbing, you know, are restraining a child for, you know, when you start, I think it kind of goes downhill from there, you know. How do you get back out of that, you know?
You know, my concern, and I'm going to, you know, get off, that was my question, is that so much emphasis is put on control, and it seems to be a lack of the teaching skill of the teacher, lack of psychological training for the part of the people in the classroom, and the poor child, as you said before, they have needs that need to be met, and this can have a long-term effect on the child for the rest of their life.
The post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah.
I would have to agree there with the caller. My son was restrained once, and I think it still haunts him to this day. Will he recover? Yes, but we have a lot of confidence building to do on his behalf. I think it's humiliating at the least. The children feel that they're different. They feel that they're isolated for something that they can't help. And it's very difficult for any of us, I think, to be objective on this issue. It creates harm. Will the kids bounce back with love and care? I think so. But I do know that in the short run, it causes problems, and it will in the long run if it's not addressed and corrected.
It also reinforces the child being seen as different.
Mm-hmm. It should also have a debrief if it occurs. It should be minor. Something like this should have a school shouldn't have to happen but one kid a year, if they have any. And they should be debriefed. When this occurs and that incident occurs and the child is restrained or put in seclusion, there should be a debrief of the child and of the staff that's involved.
You know, that's...
And
application
should be made to the parents that this occurred and for what the duration was. It's different for someone separating kids and putting them in a room for 5 minutes than having a kid held there for an entire period.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's one of the points that I didn't get to make about the policy that I got to work on, and that is that they do have staff debriefing immediately before the close of the day. they have what they call student debriefing, which is the staff who perform that intervention has to reestablish the connection with the kid. They talk about it like reestablishing the rapport with the child. And then parent notification is all in the policy. And parents need to be notified by phone or by email before the close of the day. And a meeting needs to be called for the parent to be able to come in and talk and hear what's going on. So the debriefing aspect is, I agree, it's huge.
Well, caller, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate your comments. You brought up some
Well,
really
I hate
great
to get this. I'm calling from Washington, D.C. This is Yvonne Smith from the Recovery Group.
Terrific. Yes,
hi,
I know who you are. Thank you for calling in.
Have a good day.
You too. Okay, we're going to take another caller. I mean, my heart is just aching for all of you. Okay, we're going to take area code 636. Area code 636, are you here? Hello, area code 636. Okay, I'm going to try another one. They're there, but they're not picking up. Area code 801. Area code 801, you're on the Coffee Klatch. I think so many people have been holding for so long. Okay, I'm going to try one more. Okay, I'm not able to bring the callers on. I did have another question, which, you know, what type of training do the staff and teachers usually get? Is there any type of conformed training? I mean, it just seems so obvious to me that they're dealing with children that have these special needs. They have these sensory needs. They have behavioral problems. Is there any type of regulations as far as how they're taught to treat these children?
Well, the district that I've been working with has some absolutely wonderful training available. Now, getting that training down to the frontline staff is always the problem. But, I mean, I've looked through some of the training resources that they use, and they're absolutely wonderful. They talk a lot about what you do well ahead of coming to the point of crisis. You know, how you identify. What are the things that we're looking for now? You know, how are we encouraging teachers to establish good rapport and good connections with their students? You know,
right.
So the preventative approach is really promoted in a lot of the training that I've been reading with this district that I've been working with, and I'm very impressed with what I've read. But then again, it comes down to how does that get communicated? How does that training come down to the people and the teachers and educators in the school?
Right. I mean, it just seems that, you know, that if this is a career that you choose, you should be choosing it with kindness. Where are we at as far as legislation?
You mean federally or at the state level?
Well, I know the state levels, you know, I guess those are, you know, all
okay.
dependent on the
yeah,
states,
Doug,
but
wanna...
it is.
Yeah.
The federal legislation, there was a Senate bill that kind of disappeared at the beginning of December when they were getting ready to change over Congress. It had a few things that were part of it. You may know more about this.
Mm-hmm.
But it had some wonderful stuff in it, and it also talked about positive behavioral supports and interventions. But when it came down to it, I think the teachers' union had issues with some of the wording, and they were never able to kind of work it out.
In other words, I think the bill's languishing right now. And I hope those who are on the phone from Washington, D.C. will resurrect it again, because we have to eliminate some of those fears and get rid of some of the practices that are currently being used in schools. Again, it's the triage so that we can concentrate on that 90%, which is prevention. But we've got to stop the abuse first.
And what can parents do to, you know, get legislation moving again? Well, who do parents need to contact?
I think that, and Doug, we'll both tag team this one, but we have a lot of power. I think having a parent walk into a congressperson's office is a refreshing difference from having a well-heeled lobbyist do so. So we may not be able to talk to the senator or the representative, but we could certainly talk to some of their staff members, and that will be brought up line. Writing letters to the editor, sharing our testimonies, our stories, I think those have a very powerful impact on legislators. And when we're talking about this policy, we're not talking about vast sums of money. We're just saying, don't do this. There are other ways.
Right.
So I cannot understand why, if we didn't get on the horn with our legislators and we didn't contact them and we didn't communicate with them, why they wouldn't put something in place. And if the teachers union is against it, let's bring them on board and work collaboratively to develop a point of view on this.
You know, I have one more question that I want to ask both of you, and then, you know, our time is about up. I mean, it went so quickly. What recommendations would you give a parent that's going in for an IEP with a child that is in a position where they may have restraints or seclusion used on them? What would you like to see specifically in the IEP, and how much power does that IEP give the parent?
Go ahead, Doug. You take this one.
Well, you know, that was a big talking point in the national legislation, because there was this whole issue of whether seclusion, restraint, and isolation would be included in the IEP or not. And I just think that when we start allowing for it in the child's individualized education plan, then that's a way of if you're not doing everything you can to de-escalate, if you're not doing everything you can to build on the child's positive image and the positive interventions, I mean, seclusion, restraint, isolation are for crisis intervention. They shouldn't be a part of a child's daily program. That's my gut.
Right. And can it be put in an IEP that a child is, that restraints and seclusion are not to be used on the child?
Yes.
I believe
okay.
so.
And I understand, I mean, I know that for other issues that you can be very, very specific as far as techniques that work on that child, things that the teachers or staff could do that could be proactive for that child.
Absolutely, we can say in some of the present level of performance documentation, you can talk about what the child's academic levels are. You can also talk about some of the things that the child finds comforting. So that's the perfect time to introduce the fact that sometimes my child may be overstimulated. The best way to handle this would be to let them take a short walk down a hallway with an adult holding his hand. That is something. Or one thing that he could do is he could have a band at the bottom, you know, one of those pressure bands at the bottom of his chair, so he could press his foot against that. So there are a lot of
right.
other things that you could put into.
We're about.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to cut you off. We're about to go off the air, and I did want to thank Doug for joining us. It's a very, very important topic, and it's something that parents fear, parents are dealing with, and it's just so important that they get this information. So I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Marianne, my last point is work with your IEP team. Don't alienate people. Engage with them. Have exchanges of information. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. May, thank you. Thank you for a terrific interview. And everybody on Tweet Chat, unbelievable. Just a fantastic, fantastic sharing of information. As I end the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Coffee Clutch.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.